Well, one of my childhood memories is of hanging out at my grandma's house. She had a pool in her backyard, and we'd hang out there all summer. And sometimes after swimming on a weeknight, we'd go downstairs in her basement. It was cool down there, and we'd turn on, like, my parents, my aunts and uncles would turn on Jeopardy. So I have this memory of Jeopardy being kind of this, like, old people show. Now I like it, so that tells you something about me, I guess. But I guess I've always thought of Jeopardy as being kind of this just very bland, kind of boring show, but, you know, occasionally is interesting, okay? To my surprise, a few weeks ago, Jeopardy appeared in the news headlines. And here was the gist. This guy will come up on the screen. When being announced for the show, three-time winning contestant Kelly Donahue held his thumb and forefinger together and tapped his chest, showing three fingers, presumably one for each of his wins on the show. After all, he had put up one finger after his first win and two fingers after his second. However, Mr. Donahue and his signal were attacked online as being a signal used by white supremacy groups, which apparently that is actually a symbol. But whether he did it intentionally is the question. The outcry over this hand signal, which, by the way, is also used to communicate okay, and it's also flashed by NBA players of all colors after hitting a three-pointer, but the controversy led Mr. Donahue to make this public statement on Facebook. He's being, you know, harassed. And he made the statement, "I'm truly horrified with what has been posted about me on social media. I absolutely, unequivocally condemn white supremacy and racism of any kind. People who know me personally know that I am not a racist, but for the public at large, it bears repeating, I am not a racist, and I reject and condemn white supremacy and all forms of bigotry for the evil they are." I think it's a good statement on his part. Are you surprised that he has to make that kind of statement? Are you surprised that he had to kind of justify himself? That people jump so quickly to assume, well, he must be a white supremacist because he put up those three fingers. If you have been following the news at all for the last years, really, you might wonder, is the United States, is our culture, are we more racist? Like, it seems to be, and I've been following this here the last couple of weeks more closely, almost every headline, it seems like, whether we're talking about immigration at the border, whether we're talking about something in politics, certainly the presidential election cycle here this past time, just the daily news, what's going on in Israel and Palestinian, we need to be praying for Israel, for our Jewish neighbors. Everything is presented in terms of this racial struggle. So are things more racist? Or is it possible that we're looking at things as a culture, that people are looking through things through a different worldview lens? And that's what I want to present to you this morning. And we're looking through a different lens. I'm certainly not saying that racism is not a problem in the United States. It is probably bigger than I realize. But it does seem, and this bears out in academia and again in pop culture, that this is becoming more of a focus because of the lens through which we're looking at things. So when we study worldview with our teens, we talk about worldview as being a lens through which we view the world. Kids, if you've ever played with sunglasses that are like yellow tinted or blue tinted, when you put those sunglasses on, it makes everything kind of that color, right? You put the blue sunglasses, everything looks blue. People's skin looks blue. So your worldview colors how you see the world. And you want, when you're looking at the world, when you're looking at reality, you want the best pair of glasses. You want the ones that are clear, that, you know, present things as they actually are. And that's what we want in a worldview. And we make a case that the biblical worldview is the true worldview, that God really does exist, that Jesus really is his son, that he died for our sins and rose again, that is the true worldview. That's the true way of viewing the world. But there's this other worldview now that is growing rapidly in popularity. It doesn't fit neatly into worldview categories. It's not like, a major world religion or something like that, but it is fast becoming the dominant lens through which our culture sees the world. It is a comprehensive, all-encompassing way of viewing the world. And that worldview is known as critical race theory. It is a way of viewing the world in which one is hyper-attuned to skin color and ethnicity, and which sees racism as the fundamental and pervasive issue in the world. In the critical race theory view of the world, everything is racial or racialized. Everything that happens in the news or to each of us individually is viewed through this lens of race and racism. And I'll have just a couple things. Maybe you already went through them. Whether you're talking about standardized tests and scores in schools, political policies, COVID-19, the economy, high-profile court cases, professional sports, the British monarchy, movies, and Hollywood award shows, even Jeopardy and math. Everything is viewed as racist or potentially racist or part of a system which is racist. Again, in critical race theory, race and racism becomes, again, just this dominant lens through which one views all of life. And so this morning we're going to take a look at CRT, critical race theory, and what it teaches and give a biblical analysis. And I'll just say again, I've been reading and listening, watching all kinds of things. I'm going to present the best I can, but I think this is going to be just kind of touching the surface on some things, and I'm going to give you some resources at the end, offer some resources that I think will be helpful as we continue to learn about this. I do think it's something we need to, it's not something we can just say, I don't need to know about that, I don't need to learn about that. Just a little bit of a review. If you weren't here last week, this is part two, as Sean said, and part one is online. Last week I shared that according to the biblical worldview, there is only one race, the human race. In our fallen humanity, though, we sin against one another with all kinds of sin, including the sin of racism. Racism is a sin. It's detestable to God. It's a way of disrespecting, demeaning, or damaging someone who is a fellow image bearer. We are all made in God's image, of great worth, and should treat each other accordingly. Sadly, racism and slavery have been common throughout history in almost every century and culture, and they still exist today. We also saw that according to the Bible, God has always had this vision and plan for a united humanity that crosses boundaries of skin color and ethnicity and other differences. Through the Old Testament, the life of Jesus, the mission of the church, we see God working to bring people of all shapes and sizes and colors and classes and interests into harmony with one another. And I gave a few examples of Christian men and women who have been at the forefront and leading that charge over the past few centuries. Some people might object that I'm even talking about this because I'm a white man, right? Who am I to talk about race? And I just want you to know that the ideas that I've, as I've been reading and researching, many of the things that I'm going to share have come from black or Indian authors, men and women. And so if you don't like hearing it from me, I'm glad to turn you on to a different book or author if that would help. But I think I wish that didn't matter so much. When it comes to critical race theory, there are some who genuinely want to help, that are well-intentioned. In fact, they're fighting the same thing we want to fight. I want to fight racism. I wish racism didn't exist. I wish it didn't exist in my heart. I wish it didn't exist in my community. I wish it didn't exist in the world. And so there are some who are proponents of critical race theory who really, there's plenty of common ground. We want to see the same thing come to an end. We want to see racism end. We want to see slavery end. But there's just a disagreement on how to help. How to help. And you know this, that there are some ways that, when we try to help, we actually do more harm than good. And you can think of lots of examples. Sometimes we just want to fix it right away, and we actually, do more damage in the long run. But there are different, again, in different worldviews, there are different understandings of what the problem is, different understandings of what the solution is. And so there are some ways of helping that are not actually helpful, and that's what I want to offer this morning. There are some that I don't think genuinely want to help. I think there are some people that are co-opting this movement. They're kind of, using it for their own ideological purposes, for political gain, or for increasing their own power and wealth. And I'll say a little bit more about that towards the end. As Sean said, some people might, bristle a little bit at the idea of dealing with what is considered a political issue in the church. And I just wanted to add a couple more thoughts to that, as Sean mentioned that. Just so you know, the apostles and prophets and Jesus himself regularly addressed issues that were considered political. Everything from the fairness of laws and judges, treatment of the poor, taxes, who the king had married, justice for the oppressed. These are things that are addressed Old and New Testament, including by Jesus himself. And so these topics should not be off limits for Christians. Political issues are almost always also moral issues, which, of course, we care about. We care about issues of right and wrong, righteousness, holiness. And then secondly, because critical race theory does offer this comprehensive worldview, this full way of interpreting reality, and because its ideas are so prominent, I just think it's essential that we have good biblical discernment about the specific ideas involved. We want to love God with our minds. We want to love our neighbors well in the best way. So I'm hoping to not give a purely political talk here, but again, to show how the biblical worldview would offer a critique to this different worldview. Colossians 2:8 says, "See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ." So a worldview that centers on racism rather than on the gospel of Jesus Christ is bound to go astray, and we are commanded to be on guard. And so I want to do that. Help us to do that. All right, well, what is critical race theory? You may have heard that. There's going to be a number of buzzwords. I don't want to give all the terminology here this morning. But what is critical race theory? And I'm going to kind of broaden it. Critical race theory is actually kind of a subset of a broader set of ideas called critical theory. So I'm going to start just by explaining critical theory, and then you'll see how critical race theory fits into that. Critical theory divides everyone, every human being, into one of two groups according to whether, what they're part of. And it says basically that everybody is a part of either the oppressor group, the group that is oppressive, that they're privileged, they're the group in power, or you are in the marginalized group, the oppressed group. So in this way of categorizing people, women are a historically oppressed group, and men are historically an oppressor group. They're privileged. So Carolyn, as a woman, my wife, necessarily has more social credit. Her voice is more valued because she's in this oppressed class, whereas I, as a man, especially a white man, am in the oppressor group. And so her voice has more weight, her status. She has more clout. But under critical theory, her voice doesn't count as much as that of a black woman because she's a member of two oppressed groups, black and being a woman. She wouldn't have as much credit as a black lesbian woman because LGBTQ folks are also in under critical race theory, a marginalized group, an oppressed group. A black Muslim lesbian woman in a wheelchair would have the most clout of all. Her voice matters more than any other because she has membership in these different marginalized groups. And this is what's called intersectionality. Intersectionality is the intersection of the different kind of categories that a person, the different oppressed groups, that they can kind of claim. And so a healthy, straight, white, Christian man who is cisgender, that is, he identifies in the gender that he was born as biologically, his voice matters least because of his, because of his privilege. Under critical theory, the more victimhood categories a person can claim, the more social clout they should have, their opinion matters more. Their story or their lived experience matters more. Their subjective truth that they've lived through, that trumps any, statistics that a white person could share or anything like that. And so critical theory is a form of identity politics. It de-emphasizes our status as individuals, unique individuals with each having our own history, our own family background, our own interests, decisions that we've made, and it emphasizes your identity as part of a group. And so critical race theory, again, emphasizes especially that racial aspect of oppression. So critical theory is broad, has these different kind of things that you could focus on, different oppressed groups, but critical race theory focuses specifically on racial oppression. And so obviously, you may have seen this in news stories. I think even Fox News does this now, but they will capitalize black and brown when referring to people. It's almost like it has taken on this more than a worldview, almost a religious nature. People have said that in critique of critical race theory, that it's almost a new religion. And there's kind of the idea in this new way of viewing the world. When I say new, critical theory has been actually around for a long time. Critical race theory has been around for a couple decades, but it's kind of more in the vernacular. It's more in the cultural mainstream here in the last 5 to 10 years. There's kind of this sense that you're kind of like, no matter what way you go, you're going to be called a racist. So the illustration has been given. If you're a white store owner and at the same time a black customer comes in and a white customer comes in, they both come in at the same time, who do you help first? If you help the white customer first, you're giving him preferential treatment and you're a racist. If you give the black customer your attention first, well, that's because you don't trust the black customer to be alone in the store without your attention. So you're also a racist. So it's kind of like you're darned if you do and darned if you don't. Like either way you go, whichever path you pick, you're going to be accused of racism. And that's kind of the fear. Everybody's worried, whether you own a company or you're just posting stuff on social media, it's kind of this like, I'm afraid I'm going to be called a racist. I'm afraid I'm going to be canceled or you know, kicked off Facebook or something like that. Again, this is a distinct worldview with a different view of what is the problem and what is the solution. So in the Christian worldview, the problem is sin. Sin in my heart and sin in your heart and sin in society. Okay, the problem is sin. In this critical race theory worldview, the problem is racism. Institutionalized racism. Systemic racism. And the way that we see that is in disparities, that there are different outcomes for racial groups. So percentage-wise, proportionally, there are more black men and women in jail. Black home ownership is lower than white home ownership. Test scores, graduation rates, there's disparities in the different racial groups. And so that must mean that somewhere along the line there is institutional racism. And the solution then to institutional racism or systemic racism is to overthrow the hegemonic powers. That's a fancy word, just the dominant cultural group. And so the white culture, the white supremacist culture needs to be overthrown. And in critical race theory, that can happen through a number of kind of different ways. Some of them being more peaceful, some of them at the other end of the spectrum being more leaning towards violent revolution. The first thing that needs to happen to accomplish this social justice, this accomplishing equity, getting everybody equal outcomes, not just being treated equally under the law, but having equal outcomes, that's equity. The first thing to do is to become woke. And to become woke means that you have to wake up from your privileged status and be aware of your privileged status. It's not enough just to not be a racist. You personally maybe have never said anything or done anything mean. I think probably all of us would acknowledge that we've had racist thoughts, but it's not enough to just be a non-racist. You have to be an anti-racist in this worldview. Because if you're just a non-racist, if you just say like, hey, look, I'm going to respect everybody, treat everybody the same, that's not enough because now you are complicit in the systems, right? It's not just to monitor your own behavior, your own heart, your own family. if you participate in these oppressive systems, now you are lumped in. You are complicit. So in order to become woke, you have to acknowledge your white privilege. You have to kind of shut up and listen to other people's lived experience and the oppression that they've faced. So even if you haven't had racist thoughts or engaged in racist behavior, just taking part in the systems, and the systems is kind of like everything, okay? So if you've taken part in education system, healthcare system, if you voted, if you, you know, have any government involvement, if you participated in the economy, again, all of life includes these the systems, okay? And so you have to be woke, you have to be aware of that white supremacy that exists in these systems. They say, by the way, again, there are black folks who object to critical race theory, and when they do, critical race theory people will say, well, they've actually internalized white supremacy. So even black people then are complicit in the white supremacy in that view. And so what's to be done? How do you overthrow the hegemonic powers? So either you have to reduce the power of the dominant culture, so you have to bring the white culture down, or you have to bring these other, you know, the racial minority cultures up. And so there are different ways that are suggested for doing that. One, of course, is reparations, the government giving money to these oppressed groups. Others that are suggested are defunding the police. If there is a disparity between blacks and whites when it comes to, you know, arrests for certain crimes, maybe we need to decriminalize certain things or close jails or reduce sentences. But again, there's all kinds of solutions that are suggested to bring things into parity, to get rid of the inequity there. Again, there's just a wide range of things that are suggested, but the kind of the uniting feature in critical race theory is that we need to bring it to this level. There should be equal outcomes for everybody. This is a quote from Black Lives Matter leader Hawk Newsom. He said in an interview, "If this country doesn't give us what we want, then we will burn down this system and replace it, all right? And I could be speaking figuratively. I could be speaking literally. It's a matter of interpretation." That's a little bit of a scary quotation, I think, right? He's asking us to interpret, but it's like, well, tell us what you mean. Do you mean figuratively or do you mean literally? Are you talking about literally burning things down? So again, there's this whole, you know, kind of spectrum of what solutions are actually being offered. So I think in all this, we want to be careful. Just on any controversial issue, there's always this kind of like swinging pendulum, okay? And you don't want to swing too far one way or the other. So I think one, and I've seen it in myself. I've heard it from, you know, not thinking of anybody in particular, but I've heard it from among us, you know, that there's kind of this reaction. You see this kind of stuff going on, like, ah, that's so stupid, or that's. But I do think we need to be just careful about our attitude. Like, is there something I can learn here, or is there something I need to be challenged about? I don't want to swing so far the other way. Biblically, we are called. We should care about oppressed groups, right? We should care about oppressed people. We are called to love our neighbor. We are called to love our racial minority neighbors. So how do we do that? We are called, biblically, we are called to care about justice. Micah 6:8, "He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." And so I can't overreact and say, you know, just dismiss people, or be so angry or jaded that I can't have a conversation with somebody and interact with the ideas. And I can't, you know, be so, let the pendulum swing so far that I stop caring about racism. I want to do that. I want to root out racism in my own heart and in my family and in my community. But I don't want to overreact the other way. I am in favor of putting an end to racism. My worldview requires that. I think it's a noble goal to say, yes, we want to end racism. I think it's unlikely because we live in a fallen world. Like, I would like to rid the world of lying, but I don't think that's probably a realistic goal. So I'll say very clearly here, if there is a genuinely racist law on the books, it should be changed and Christians should lead the charge. if there is a truly racist police officer or judge or politician who is ruling, giving out sentences unjustly, the Bible says the Lord hates dishonest scales. We should hate dishonest scales just like God does. There shouldn't be this imbalance in justice that some people are treated differently because of their income or their skin color or their weight or anything like that. Okay, with that introduction, and again, I'm leaving a lot out here, but I want to go on to a little bit of a critique of critical race theory, and I've already started into that a bit, but the first thing I want to say here is that critical race theory is overly simplistic. It is overly simplistic. So these first two will have to do with just the issue of truth. The Bible calls us to seek the truth. We're actually called to love the truth. God loves the truth and actually says he despises a lying tongue. Jesus is the truth. So we should go after the truth. And truth is not always simple. Sometimes it's complex. And so just shouting racism or like jumping to that conclusion is not a good approach. And so critical race theory mistakes a part of the truth for the whole. Yes, there's racism. Yes, it is a problem. Yes, it has been and could still be institutionalized, systemic in some ways. But that's not the whole picture. There are other problems that are not racial, right? Another way of being overly simplistic is that critical race theory lumps people with great diversity into one pot. So all black people, all white people. But even among white families in Salina, there's a great deal of diversity of lifestyle, income, values. The same is true of black families. So to lump all white people together and all black people together, overly simplistic. It'll come up on the screen. There's a Babylon Bee. This is a spoof. This is humorous. A headline about LeBron James pulling over in his sports car there to lecture a homeless man on his white privilege. And it's trying to draw out the humor there. Obviously, LeBron James is a very privileged. Yes, he's black. And yes, I don't know what happened to his ancestors. But he is a very, very privileged guy. I don't know anything about, you know, the background of the average white homeless guy. But can you really say, under critical race theory, you'd have to say that a black middle-class kid with an intact family, that he's worse off than a white kid in Appalachia who grew up in a broken home and an abusive stepdad? Is that really? You see, there's some nuance missing, right? To say that all black people are oppressed and all white people are oppressors, it just doesn't quite get to the nuanced complexity of truth. Another way that critical race theory is overly simplistic is that it assumes that disparities in racial groups result from injustice. So it assumes that just because, for example, if there's a higher graduation rate among white students than black students, that there must be racism going on. But that's not necessarily the case. I think it's appropriate to ask the question, are you sure it's racism? Like, are there other possible explanations? Some disparities result from the different decisions that people make, the different values that certain cultures and subcultures have. For example, there are more men in prison than women. More men in prison than women. Does that mean that our social, our justice system is oppressive towards men? Or is it possible that men commit more crimes than women? There are more black men in the NBA than white men. Does that mean that the NBA is racist towards white men? Or are there other possible explanations? Certainly there are, right? In the NHL, the hockey league, there are more white men than black men. Does that mean that the NHL is actively keeping people, black men, out of the NHL? Where I went to school, I went to college at Ohio Northern, and the engineering, if you look through the yearbook, the engineering department is like all dudes, and then like one or two girls in there. Is the engineering department trying to keep girls out of engineering? No. Actually, there's scholarships available for women. They're trying to attract women into the different engineering fields. But girls make different decisions. Women make different decisions. They choose to go into nursing, education, more so than guys. And so, again, it just fails to account for the nuance, the complexity of the truth. These disparities among blacks and whites don't necessarily show injustice. They could. They might. But I think it's worth delving into that, looking. So, again, this accusation that police are racist, that the defund the police because the system is racist. Well, what about areas where a majority of the cops are themselves black, and the mayor is black, and the police chief is black? Are you saying that is all, they're all racist, they're all complicit in this white supremacy? Again, it's just overly simplistic. Okay, a second critique here is that critical race theory is based on assumptions, emotions, and subjective truth. So again, I mentioned this idea before that that the more intersectionality you have, the more oppressed groups that you're a part of, the more your voice counts, okay? And so that's putting subjective truth, that's putting one person's anecdotal, like the story of their life, that's putting that above, looking at the data. And so if I try to present data that says, hey, look, maybe it's not racism, maybe there's something else going on, well, you're white, and that's data, and the lived experience of the person in that oppressed group, that trumps everything, that outweighs everything else. And so there's this, the word epistemology just means how do we know things? And so I would say critical race theory has this faulty epistemology. Vadi Bakum calls it ethnic Gnosticism. It's the secret knowledge that the people in the oppressed groups have that you don't have access to. Okay, I want to offer just a couple, sorry, I skipped a couple things. Critical race theory based on assumptions, emotions, and subjective truth. Again, we've had these shootings and the crowd rushes out into the streets and they just assume, like, before there's even time to have a trial, it's like, let the facts come out, like, let things happen. But there's the Twitter mob, and then there's the movements in the street. It's like, don't base it on emotion. Let things play out. Justice will be brought about, and if it doesn't, then we'll deal with it, you know? But instead, it's all emotion and subjective truth here. I want to give you a couple reasons to think that our nation is not systemically racist. And again, this is not just me saying this. I hope you don't hear me say, like, trying to defend turf as a white guy or something. There are reasons to think that our nation has been, for decades, really, growing and becoming less racist. And here are some reasons to think that we're not as systemically racist as they're saying, as the critical race theory people are saying. One is the existence of race hoaxes. You'll remember the Jussie Smollett, the actor who, claims to have been attacked by white men. It was all set up. It was a fake. Why, if America was as systemically racist as they're saying, why would there be hoaxes? There have been there are actually dozens of these race hoaxes over the last couple years. Another reason to maybe think that we're not as systemically racist, and again, I don't want to downplay racism. Racism is sin. It's wrong, but we shouldn't have to, come up with these fake examples. Obviously, an important one here in the news recently in the last couple months is white cops killing unarmed black men. It was claimed that this is a pandemic. It's on the rise. Neil Shenvey, a Christian, a critic of critical race theory, he says, the data I could find shows that deaths by legal intervention for both blacks and whites have decreased steadily from 1970 to 2010. Similarly, the number of unarmed black people killed by police in 2015 to 2017, according to the Washington Post database, was 38, then 17, then 19, respectively. I've seen interviews where they interview man on the street, and people were like, how many black people do you think are killed by the police each year? And they're saying thousands, hundreds and thousands, and, you know, so many people. It's happening every day. Like, our lives are under threat constantly every day. I worry that my kid's going to get... It's 38, 17, and 19, and apparently in 2019 there were 13. Now, that's horrible. I don't want anybody to die. I don't want anybody to be shot by the police. That's all very sad. So I don't want to just say, oh, it's no big deal. But it's not a pandemic. It's not an epidemic. It's not, you know, the numbers have been going down steadily without the help of critical race theory. Another clue that maybe we're not as systemically racist as a culture is this phenomenon known as microaggressions. Microaggressions. That's where words that you wouldn't, you know, kind of normally associate with racism are kind of like, oh, I'm very offended by that. That has racial overtones. Again, going back to the Jeopardy example. Okay? So microaggressions. If racism is that bad, you wouldn't think you'd have to, like, kind of like drag up these little things. And again, I don't want to be insensitive. Maybe they're not little for somebody, but, like, I wish somebody would have said to that guy on Jeopardy, like, hey, I don't know if you know this, but that symbol actually has different meanings, and it could be interpreted this way, but instead it's racist. You know, it's like this automatic accusation. So if there's something I'm doing that's, you know, really causing somebody offense, I want to know about that. I don't want to, you know, I want to learn from that and not do that. But goodness, is it good for our culture to be so easily offended by microaggressions? And if we're really that racist, why do we need to keep harping on the microaggressions? Okay, and then the last reason to suggest that we're maybe not as racist as the critical race theory people are saying is that black Africans, like people from Africa, want to come to the United States as much as anybody. When asked, like, where would you like to, if you're in Nigeria, where do you want to move? The United States. They want to move to the United States. Why do they want to move here? Why would they want to move to such a racially oppressive place? Actually, black immigrants do really, really well when they come to the United States. So is it possible that the reason black immigrants do better than, you know, American-born African-Americans do? Is it possible there's a cultural difference, not because of racism? Is it possible that black kids are struggling for different reasons than racism? And I think the answer is yes. Did you know that 67% of black children are being raised in single-parent homes? That seems to be a really, really significant factor. Now, it's not racist to acknowledge that difference. If I say black people can't stay faithful to one another because they're black, that would be racist. But if I said, look, different policies have allowed people to, you know, be motivated by different things, to engage in certain behaviors, and that has decimated the black family. It's not because of their race. It's because of policies. It's because of individual choices people have made. That's not racism. Statistically, in schools and in income, Asian Americans do better than white Americans. Is it racism towards white Americans that causes that? No, the disparity is not based on racism. Okay, number three, and I'll go through these a little bit more quickly. Critical race theory undermines taking personal responsibility for actions and decisions. It pushes a victim mentality, and victim mentality is really bad for us. When we blame, you know, outside circumstances, we all have that inclination. We want to blame, well, the reason I'm this way is because my parents were this way, or my school was, you know, this way, or, you know, because of racism. Again, if somebody has experienced genuine racism, I'm sorry to hear that you had to live through that. But should we, as a group, as a rule, say all black people are victims of this vicious racism, when that it really is crippling. There's that quote from Remember the Titans. The coach says, when you're helping the black coach says to the white coach, when you're helping the black players, you're not actually helping them. You're crippling them. So it reinforces this crippling victim mentality. Critical race theory reinforces the divisions rather than building bridges. It justifies destruction and crime. They say, no justice, no peace. And people stand up and say, well, those rioters, they have a right to be concerned. This has been called the soft bigotry of low expectations. This is what we expect from black people, to riot. So critical race theory undermines taking personal responsibility. It justifies rage and violence instead of assuming the best about people, bearing with one another, explaining your concerns. Number four, critical race theory is racist. It claims to be anti-racist, but it is racist. Now, I'm not saying everybody who holds these views is racist, but it is a racist worldview. Remember, Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream was that we would focus on character, not on color of skin. But critical race theory focuses on color of skin rather than character. So it's not possible that a white person could not be a white supremacist because you take part in the system. So it assumes that it attributes to all white people white supremacy. That's racist. Racists say that race is the most important thing about a person. Anti-racists also say that race is the most important thing about a person. And so social justice, while it claims this emphasis on social justice and racial parity, it actually ends up causing more division, causing more racism. You may know that some colleges were having separate dorms for black students and white students. And this was viewed as progressive. But that's just segregation again. It's just repackaged to put black and white students in separate dorms. Or that some colleges have had separate graduation ceremonies. You may have seen in the news that the black woman who's a mayor of Chicago this week, she said she would only have sit-down interviews with reporters of color. That's racism. That's racism. So critical race theory is a racist movement. It's at odds with the Christian worldview, and it's an enemy of the gospel. It's an attack on the gospel. It claims to be anti-racist, but it ends up pitting black and white people against each other. Okay, number five, critical race theory focuses on false solutions. It focuses on false solutions. How could you get everybody to have parity? Like, how could you get everybody? So my siblings, I'm one of five, and we've all made different decisions in our life. I have siblings that make more than me. I have siblings that make less than me, who have more kids than me. None have more kids than me. I won in that category. We have different numbers of kids is what I meant to say. But we've made these decisions. So if my brother, for example, if he makes a lot more money and lives in a bigger house, I could say, well, my parents loved him more than me. Or we're just different individuals. He has different gifts than I do. He made different decisions. He chose a different college major. He chose to get married later and have fewer kids. So we have, like, there are other factors, right? We can't just say, well, it's based on who our parents loved more and accuse my parents of some kind of oppression. So the false solution here is, well, again, so it's to blame, to try to get equity, to try to get parity. It's impossible. How could you get every racial group, subgroup, and again, knowing that there's such variety even within these different racial subgroups, how could you possibly get that? You would need a really big government to do that, a really big controlling government, which is the scary part. When critical race theory focuses on money as a solution, we know that that doesn't work, right? Money doesn't fix people's problems. In fact, a lot of times it exacerbates people's problems. Black and white, people who win the lottery, that doesn't make them rich. It just gives them more money to be foolish with in a lot of cases. So it offers these false solutions. If someone really cares about black lives in America, here are some steps that we should take. We should teach the biblical worldview of race and the image of God and man. Our culture is in captivity to secularism. You came from a monkey. You're an accident of nature. So nobody has value. The biblical worldview says everybody has value. Black, white, whatever. If you really cared about black lives in America, you would end abortion on demand, because black babies are much more likely to be killed in the womb, and black abortion abortion facilities are much more likely to be set up in majority black neighborhoods. If you care about black lives, you care about ending abortion on demand. If you really cared about black lives and equality, you would enact policies that encourage and support the nuclear family rather than weaken it. Your family is the biggest factor. Like, statistically, your family is the biggest factor when it comes to outcomes for graduation and whether you're arrested or not, whether you commit crimes, whether you spend time in jail, how you do economically. Family is the biggest factor. Black Lives Matter at one point had on their website that they wanted to weaken, they wanted to deconstruct the Western prescribed nuclear family. It's not Western prescribed. It's nature. It's God's design. Number six, critical race theory distorts our sense of identity. You kind of already said this. I'll just go quickly. Our sense of identity should not be found in our skin color. Ultimately, you will not find your identity, your true, like, who am I really? You will not find that in a group that you belong to, your skin color or your interests even. Ultimately, you will only find your identity, who you really are, when you come to God in humility and put your faith in Jesus Christ. That's who you really are. So you were made by God to know Him and love Him and glorify Him. 2 Corinthians 5:16 says, as Paul, so from now on we regard no one from a worldly point of view, though we once regarded Christ in this way. We do so no longer. Okay, and the last one here is critical race theory leads to bullying. Critical race theory leads to bullying, both government and corporate. One of the most popular, there are a couple kind of books and authors that are prominent. Amazingly, critical race theory, you would think it's kind of like mainly black authors and that are pushing this. Actually, some of the most prominent are white professors. Abram X. Kendi, he's a black man. He wrote a book called How to Be an Anti-Racist. And on his website, he published an article called Pass an Anti-Racist Constitutional Amendment. Now, again, you'd think, okay, he's a black guy. He just wants to be treated fairly. We should hear him out. You know, maybe he's got a way to end racism. But listen, to this ends up just being a big political power grab. He says, to fix the original sin of racism, Americans should pass an anti-racist amendment to the U.S. Constitution that enshrines two guiding anti-racist principles. Racial inequity is evidence of racist policy, and the different racial groups are equals. We'd agree with definitely that second one, but not the first. The amendment would make unconstitutional racial inequity over a certain threshold. So it would make unconstitutional if there's disparity between two groups to a certain degree. It would establish and permanently fund the Department of Anti-Racism, the DOA, comprised of formally trained experts on racism and no political appointees. The DOA would be responsible for pre-clearing all local, state, and federal public policies to ensure they won't yield racial inequity, monitor these policies, investigate private racist policies when racial inequity surfaces, and monitor public officials for expressions of racist ideas. The DOA would be empowered with disciplinary tools to wield over and against policymakers and public officials who do not voluntarily change their racist policies and ideas. That is a power grab, right? That is basically, we want the power to bully people into going along with this false worldview. So this is the tolerant crowd, showing their hand as being very authoritarian. Some of the stuff that has come from critical race theory is just nonsense. At one point, the Smithsonian Museum listed on their, they had a list of things that were part of white supremacist culture, white dominant culture, and they included things on there like hard work and rational thought, saying rational thought and hard work are part of white culture. Who's the racist? That's so insulting, right? I would think. That's racism towards black folks. the constantly shifting standards, the hypocrisy, the canceling, no grace, forcing people to make apologies for things that weren't racist. It's bullying. It's a power grab. And so, I think we need to see kind of through the curtain. Yes, there are people who are genuinely well-intentioned that we can, hey, let's talk about what are the best solutions to end racism. I share that concern. I share that goal with you. But there are people who, again, want to co-opt this movement for ideological gain. Okay, just so you know, there are increasingly pastors, Christian leaders who are embracing critical race theory. I hope you see it for the danger. I don't know if I've done that well enough this morning, but I hope you see it for the challenge it is to biblical Christianity. This is not something that like fits into the biblical. It's a piece that doesn't belong to our puzzle. It doesn't fit the biblical worldview. But unfortunately, Christian leaders, some Christian leaders and pastors are incorporating, especially some of the mega churches, some of the more well-known guys that I, you know, have thought well of in the past, and still, you know, have learned good things from them, are embracing some of the critical race theory, not just the lingo, but some of the ideas. And I think that will have bad impact. I know it will have bad impact in their churches and in their audiences. So I think we need to be on guard. Again, we don't want to be taken captive by hollow and deceptive philosophy. Okay, well, what should we do? What should we do as Christians? Again, I want to say that we should learn more. And I've got a number of people to recommend to you, books, videos. To, you know, if you're interested at all in this, I've been through a lot of resources. Vadi Baucham is a black pastor. He's got lots of great things to say on this. He's got a book out and some talks online. Neil Shenvey is another that I mentioned. He's got a website, Shenvey Apologetics. He's got book reviews and, you know, talks that he's done online and lots of great stuff there. There are a number of black men who are not Christians even that have good things to say. John McWhorter is not a Christian, not a conservative even, but he's very critical of the critical race theory movement. He's a linguist from Columbia University. Really interesting to listen to. Certainly plenty of things there that I disagree with. But another person that's been helpful to me is Dennis Prager in the PragerU videos. He's Jewish. He doesn't share, you know, our Christian convictions on everything, but he's got some good things to say. And those PragerU videos, if you're not familiar with those, very good, like short soundbite kind of things that can help clear up some misunderstanding about things. And I would just say, again, just as a warning to us, not to let the pendulum swing so far, you know, one way or the other. Don't let yourself become jaded or angry. Don't overreact. Don't become unreasonable. Don't lose focus that racism is really, it really is a terrible sin that is not honoring to God. Again, back to Micah 6:8. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? What does God want from us? To act justly. We should pursue justice in our own lives, in our own communities, with our vote, with our voice, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. We've got to do all three things, not just act justly, but also love mercy, also walk humbly with our God. And so Sean's going to come close in a minute, and we'll have song after that. I just want to encourage us, the best thing I think we can do is to live out a vibrant relationship with the Lord, vibrant relationships with one another, where we're really pursuing the truth, reading God's word, looking at other good resources, and then living it out, being the church that God has called us to be, having the quality of relationship, showing the world, this is how you do conflict resolution. We bear with one another well. We don't assume the worst about each other. We don't make these accusations, these hasty accusations. This is how we live in brotherly harmony with one another in the church. And so we want to be that light. We want to be those ambassadors. And so we need to have that vibrant relationship with God, really living it out and loving one another well. So, all right, Sean.
A common biblical metaphor to illustrate ignorance is darkness, and we're told that the world lives in darkness. In fact, that John, it says that the world loves darkness, and so, but even in the world, I think people sense things aren't as they should be. We've got problems, But when you don't come at those problems through a biblical worldview, now you misdiagnose the problems. And when you misdiagnose the problem, then you misdiagnose the solution. And so critical race theory is not the solution to our problems. The gospel of Jesus Christ is the solution to our problems. In critical race theory, there is no grace. It's works righteousness. And even more depressing, we've talked about works righteousness systems before and how you could never know if you've done enough good works to please God. And the gospel is so wonderful. We know that Christ did it all. So, like, if you're in a works righteousness system, then you just keep working, hoping that maybe you've pleased God enough that he could accept you now, and which is so different from the gospel. Well, critical race theory is actually worse. You know that you can actually never do enough good. So you can't even have the hope that you could. So there's no grace in this theory. And again, maybe some of you are thinking, well, I don't know that we're buying into any of this. Let me tell you, they're coming for your kids and your grandkids. Thankfully, Texas just outlawed critical race theory in the schools. So that's a good thing. I don't know what Ohio's going to do with it. But understand that it is an assault on the gospel itself. It's not maybe seen that way, but that is what it is. Our solution is the gospel of Jesus Christ, where in Christ there's no black or white, no slave or free, no Jew or Greek. No, we're all in Christ. We're all equal because we're all sinners, and he came to redeem us all and love us all and invite us all to be with him through Christ. And so the gospel, we have to keep going back to it. And as Phil said, it's not just preaching it, it's living it out. We've said this before. Our lives should bear testimony to the truth of the gospel. Our lives should be unexplainable. The lives that we live as Christians should be unexplainable apart from the gospel. Why do they love each other that way? Why do they sacrifice for each other that way? Why do they forgive each other that way? We've not seen this before. What is it? What is it about them? It's Christ. And so let's have that commitment, not just to speak the truth, but to live the truth together. We're going to now close with song, and we're going to celebrate the gospel. Not me, not us, Christ. What Christ has done for all of us. Let's sing.
Will you stand, please?